This cold snap is breaking records and filling local homeless shelters. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Dan Boyce has the first in a five-part series on impacts from the Bakken oil boom. Tonight's story focuses on infrastructure. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with noted historian James Oakes about some of the myths Americans have about the Civil War. A National Weather Service meteorologist says the cold snap hitting much of the West has set or matched record low temperatures in parts of Montana. Dave Bernhardt says temperatures in Great Falls were recorded at 22 below yesterday and minus 26 early this morning. Both readings broke records going back to 1972 and 1980. Denton also set a record at minus 23 this morning, and Havre's 27 below reading matched a record set as soon as 1936. Bernhardt says temperatures dropped below minus 30 degrees overnight in places along the High Line, the Little Belt Mountains, and in pockets of the southern valleys. The bitter cold is driving homeless people into shelters at record numbers. Aaron Fowler-Pahan, executive director of the Poverello Center in Missoula, says 119 people checked into the center's shelter this weekend, the highest number they've ever housed.
Those frigid temperatures are also being blamed for a frozen pipe that burst in flooded parts of the Montana State Capitol building. A pipe burst on the first floor of the historic building near the post office early this morning as temperatures plummeted. Department of Administration spokeswoman Cheryl Olson says Capitol security guards first noticed the burst pipe just before 3 a.m.
We got to between 10 and 14 below, depending where you were in the Helena Valley. And as a result, one of the pipes burst. We were prepared for it. We saw the weather coming, so we had gathered all kinds of fans and wet weather gear, so if we had a flood, we'd be ready. And about a half hour later, we had people on scene to get the water shut off, but in the meantime, we had water that was running from the south side of the Capitol throughout the entryway of the first floor, but the water was also cascading down the stairs into the basement, and then that was our main concern because it was flowing towards places where we have a lot of electronic equipment.
But Olson says there was only minor flooding in the cafeteria, media rooms, and some bathrooms.
So as a result, we have a big cleanup going on right now. The Capitol is filled with dehumidifiers and fans that are trying to extract all the water out of the air, and we have crews over there that are starting to cut into the sheetrock and remove the baseboards so that there's no chance that we can get any moisture damage that could result in mold problem in the Capitol.
Most of the building remained open for business and public meetings as workers dried the soaked areas. The cafeteria will be closed for the rest of the week. Olson says she hopes this incident serves as a sort of cautionary tale for professional facility managers and homeowners alike.
These cold weather snaps can find weak spots in our infrastructure, and this one happened last night.
A damage estimate is not yet available. The domed Capitol building was completed in 1902 after 6 years of construction and has undergone renovations over the years. Historic paintings by Western artist Charles M. Russell and others were undamaged in the flooding.
And in other news from around the state, eastern Montana's economy continues to see a surge due to oil and gas development. Unemployment in the counties closest to the Bakken oil boom averages almost 2% below the state average. The oil industry brought in $200 million in tax revenue to the state and local governments last year alone. But all that activity comes with a cost, too, and eastern Montana communities are feeling some of the biggest impacts. This month, we're bringing you a series of stories on the side effects of this modern-day gold rush, both positive and negative. Tonight, the first part in that series, as Capitol reporter Dan Boyce explores what a big-time oil boom does to small-town infrastructure.
Sonny's Family Restaurant, a cozy corner diner in the heart of Sidney, Montana.
There's no way.
Customers are reacting to an extra jolt on top of their morning coffee.
He just hit the corner of the building.
Because a semi just took a turn too sharp and dragged the side of his trailer across the diner's awning.
Bro, my God, look.
Ripping a gaping hole in the trailer.
The jackknife.
The young driver's now got the truck jackknifed in the middle of the intersection. He's moving it back and forth trying to fix that. The truck traffic down Sydney's Central Avenue is almost constant. big rigs taking equipment to the oil fields, others carting the oil off to market.
We see these pounding there every day.
This here,
day after day after day,
is Sydney Mayor Brett Smelser. He's standing out on the sidewalk by Central Avenue.
Are you getting cold yet?
It's a few degrees below zero. Passing semis leave heavy clouds of white exhaust.
A little chilly. I'm just warming up.
Smelser was elected mayor in 2001, years before new fracking technologies brought big oil back to the Bakken region. Sydney has transformed so much in that time. Smelser says traffic is up as much as 50% in the last 5 or 6 years, pounding local roads into gravel. New hotels and housing are straining the city's sewer system to its limit, project after project.
They just keep coming and coming.
Sydney brings in about $10 million a year in taxes, but it has $55 million in infrastructure needs right now.
We do need some help out here. The people in Sydney have suffered enough. We've raised their water and sewer rates. We doubled their water and sewer hookup fees. We've initiated impact fees.
The oil industry, in one way or another, is largely responsible for these impacts. But Smelser isn't looking to the oil companies for more help. He believes the taxes they pay make sense, and the companies give to the community in other ways, like to the local Boys and Girls Club. He's looking squarely at state government, specifically Governor Steve Bullock's office, and he's not looking happy.
It aggravates me. It's a betrayal. I had a promise that it would be signed, that we would get some help from this governor.
When Smelser says that,
I had a promise that it would be signed.
He's talking about a bill from the 2013 legislature, a bill which would have provided about $35 million to Eastern Montana oil boom towns for their infrastructure needs. It passed both the Montana House and Senate with huge majorities. Smelser says the city of Sydney made calculated decisions to move forward with some projects.
We thought that money was coming.
But the money did not come. Governor Bullock vetoed the Eastern Montana Infrastructure Bill, one of more than 70 bills he axed from this last legislative session.
I had to veto $150 million of their spending or tax cuts.
He says he had to do so to balance the budget. Lawmakers left it spending more than the state was bringing in. Also, Bullock maintained throughout the legislature he wanted to keep $300 million of extra money in the bank for the next legislative session in 2015.
To protect us from floods, fires, government shutdowns, all those pieces, that was the number that ultimately, as I managed the budget, that I wanted to make sure is there for a rainy day fund.
Well, first of all, we know that the revenue forecast ended up being much higher.
Culbertson Republican Representative Austin Knutson, and he's right. The governor's own figures estimate the budget in 2015 to be about $350 million, $50 million more than what he wanted. Remember, the infrastructure bill was $35 million. Those higher estimates were presented before the deadline for lawmakers to override the governor's vetoes. Sydney Mayor Brett Smelser thinks Bullock should have convinced lawmakers, particularly Democrats, to bring the bill back to life when those higher revenue numbers were known. Even without that bill, Bullock points out the state has invested $68 million in loans or grants for Eastern Montana infrastructure since he took office.
And that's new money from roads and bridges to water systems and other things.
That includes nearly $8 million just in the community of Sydney. And Bullock says he's actively looking for more ways to attend to these infrastructure needs.
One of our city crew collecting twice as much garbage as we did 2 years ago.
Mayor Smelser has another idea for bringing more money to Eastern Montana oil communities. The Montana League of Cities and Towns says taxes on oil and gas production in Montana bring in more than $200 million a year.
State keeps 52%, counties get 25%, and the school districts get 20-some.
Eastern Montana communities only get about 1% of those funds. Smelser would like to see that changed. The truck with the jagged hole ripped in its side parks nearby. The young driver comes into Sonny's family restaurant, joking he's had better days. Most of the customers have turned back to their coffee, their fresh omelets and hash browns. A police officer outside looks at the damage to the building. He says last time, It was the movie theater. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Sydney.
One of the leading historians of 19th century America is in Missoula to speak at the University of Montana. James Oakes teaches history at the City University of New York and has written several award-winning books on the Civil War and slavery. In this feature interview, Oakes talks with news director Sally Mock about the debate over whether the Civil War was fought over preserving the Union or over slavery. Oakes says it most definitely was fought to end slavery.
Because the Republican Party, didn't exist until the middle of the 1850s, was an anti-slavery party and managed...
As opposed to the Democrats.
The Democrats are not an anti-slavery party. They're a pro-slavery party, if anything.
The
North, they're at best neutral about slavery. I mean, the slavery issue actually splits the Democratic Party as well and opens the way for the success of Lincoln and the Republicans in 1860. But the Republicans were an anti-slavery party committed to a very particular set of policies that that come out of the anti-slavery movement beginning in the 1830s, designed to surround the South the metaphor they used was like a scorpion girt by fire until slavery would sting itself to death. Right? It was a policy that recognized that the Constitution protected slavery in the states where it already existed, but was based on the hope that if you prevented slavery from expanding, if you returned the enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Clause to the states, if you suppressed slavery on the high seas, if you abolished it in Washington, D.C., if you did all these things and surrounded the South.
It was called a cordon of freedom.
A cordon of freedom. With a cordon of freedom, then slavery would be put on what Lincoln called a course of ultimate extinction. That's what the policy of the Republican Party is. It's the reason the South seceded from the Union. They were very clear about this. It was the cordon of freedom policy that they were seceding to avoid. It was a pro-slavery reaction to the election of an anti-slavery president committed to a particular set of anti-slavery policies, which they did, in fact, implement.
And as you said, this movement, anti-slavery movement, had developed long before the war.
Yes. In a sense, the anti-slavery movement begins with the American Revolution. Right? During the American Revolution and the immediate aftermath of the American Revolution, states in the North began abolishing slavery one by one, and the accumulation of states that abolished slavery constitutes the entity that we call the North. The North is the place where slavery was abolished, and the South is the place where the states did not abolish slavery. And from that moment on, there is a difference between the North and the South that is based on slavery.
And eventually, the Republicans who were leading this anti-slavery effort realized the cordon of freedom wasn't going to work, wasn't going to be
They realized enough. It wasn't going to be enough.
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 Right.
I hesitate to say that it didn't work. I say it wasn't adequate. It was necessary but not sufficient to get slavery abolished. Yes. I've actually begun to... I get this question a lot about whether it would have worked without the war and things like that. And I've thought a lot about it in the years since I published the book, in fact, and have begun to tell people that it did work. And that's based on the conclusion of the book, which was where I started, in a sense, that it took a 13th Amendment ultimately to get slavery finally and fully abolished, that the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't enough, that the cordon of freedom wasn't enough. But if you say that, if you accept that, and I firmly believe that, then you ask the question, what does it take to get an amendment to the Constitution passed? And in a sense, the number of slaves emancipated by the proclamation or by whatever means is irrelevant. What you need is to shift the balance of power between slave and free states, because you need three-quarters of the states to ratify an amendment. So in 1860, when the war begins, there are 18 free states and 10 and 15 slave states. There's no way you could get an anti-slavery amendment that way. But after 4 years of intensive pressure on the southern states to abolish slavery, the loyal slave states in particular, the balance of power has shifted, and there were, in January of 1865, 26 slave states, free states, 26 free states, and 10 slave states. One more state. If one more state abolished slavery, the ratio would be 27 to 9, and you'd have the three quarters you need to get an amendment. So in a sense, the Cordon of Freedom is designed to get states to begin abolishing slavery on their own. And it worked, in a sense. But it needed the war to work, because it wasn't the same policy that Republicans had imagined, which was a peacetime policy. It was the peacetime policy on steroids, in a sense, you know.
I think one of the other myths many of us have about the Civil War is that the war basically freed the slaves, and when in fact, at the end of the war, I think it was like 14% of the 4 million slaves had been freed.
Had been emancipated by means of military emancipation, right. Well, in one sense, the myth is correct. I mean, the war made the abolition of slavery possible, right? It's just that it hadn't freed every single slave.
Far
in
from
of
it.
Itself, it couldn't. It's inconceivable that it's hard to imagine what it would take for the Union Army to reach 4 million slaves scattered over half a continent. You know, it's just too big a physical problem. And as it was, they were overwhelmed by the number of slaves who already were running to their lines. And it's important to understand that policy of military emancipation, which is a different policy from the Cordon of Freedom policy, that is, military emancipation is the Union Army going into the South and emancipating slaves who come to their lines. That was not the policy that the Republican Party or the abolitionist movement was committed to. It was just something belligerents do in wartime. They free slaves. You know, the British and the Americans both did it during the American Revolution. The British did it during the War of 1812. The Americans did it during the Seminole War. Belligerents free slaves in an effort to suppress an insurrection. And so everyone knew about military emancipation when the war began, and certainly the abolitionists were committed to doing that as quickly as possible, but they did do it pretty quickly. It's just that, like the Cordon of Freedom, it was radicalized by the war. The policy was turned into a policy designed to abolish slavery, which was not the case in the earlier wars, and it was by itself not enough, but it was necessary. Was a necessary precondition to getting the abolition amendment through.
The other debate that you have solved for yourself is whether Lincoln was the reluctant emancipator or the great emancipator.
Well, I say neither. The focus of my book, and the surprise for me, because I had no intention of making it this kind of book, the surprise for me was the role of Congress, the important role that Congress plays, and the recognition that Lincoln was first and foremost a party man, a Republican party man, and the party was committed to a certain set of policies, and he was too much a party man ever to want to deviate from that. The party was an anti-slavery party. He was an anti-slavery president. He was committed to a particular set of policies designed to abolish slavery, to get slavery on the course of ultimate extinction. When Congress passes a law beginning in July of 1861, right at the first summer of the war, as soon as Congress comes into special session to deal with the war, passes a law that begins emancipation, Lincoln signs it and implements it. Right? There's no evidence of reluctance on his part to do what he and his fellow Republicans were pretty clearly determined to do, which was use the war and use the power they'd gained by secession and by election to destroy slavery.
You've seen the film Lincoln, and what's your opinion of that film?
Oh, it's changed over time. I've seen it 3 times, and I just watched it again last week at home with my family, because my son is doing a history project for his 6th grade class, and it's about Lincoln. He wanted to do Lincoln. So we watched it again, and I thought it was a little ponderous. You know, it has about 5 endings, which other people have pointed out. There are things about it that I like a lot. I think it's a smart movie in many ways. The screenplay is smart, and it makes intellectual
and
demands.
Accurate on the whole?
Well, we'll get to that. It's accurate in a very large sense, in the sense that it does allow us to see how important the 13th Amendment was in getting slavery without getting slavery abolished, without denigrating Lincoln. In fact, I think, elevating Lincoln to a larger role in the ratification process than he actually deserves. That is, strictly speaking, in constitutional terms, presidents have nothing to do with amendments. Right? He never endorsed the amendment until it became part of the Republican Party platform in 1864 after he was renominated. By then, it had been introduced in Congress. It had been debated in Congress. The Senate had passed it. It had gone through a very rancorous debate in the House where the Democrats had managed to block it by a one-third. All they needed was a third, you know, of the votes in the House to stop it, and they stopped it. And Lincoln, all through that process, said nothing about the 13th Amendment. There's no reason he should. There's no reason to believe he opposed it. But he's not part of the process. And you can't tell that, really, from the movie. It's not clear, I think, enough. And it goes back to what I said earlier, that the role of Congress in this process has been underestimated by focus we have. I think, you know, in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, we live in a world of what Arthur Schlesinger, the historian, once called the imperial presidency. We look to the president. The president introduces legislation to Congress, sends bills to Congress. And, well, that's not the way it was back then. Lincoln never sent a bill to Congress. They didn't do it that way. So.
You've also written that you don't agree with those who think slavery would have eventually died out of its own inherent evil. And you've said, quote, that only by driving a constitutional stake through the heart could slavery be fully destroyed.
Well,
that we could have ended up with slavery still in existence.
Yeah. And not only that, I think the abolition of slavery in the United States, the failure, the abolition of slavery in the United States during the Civil War, I think, spelled the death knell of slavery in the last two major slave-owning societies in the New World, which is Cuba and Brazil, and within a couple of decades, they both abolished slavery. But had it not been abolished in the United States, had the South managed to secure its independence, it was determined to expand the reach of slave society. It might have gone into California if they could wrest Southern California away, but it certainly wanted to go into Mexico and Central America and those kinds of places. They would have reopened the Atlantic slave trade. Instead, we closed it during the Civil War, thanks to a treaty with Great Britain. So I think we look back and it looks so inevitable to us. Of course, it was so evil and it was so terrible. You know, it had to go. It would have gone. But I don't see any reason to believe that. At the time it was destroyed, one of the reasons it was so difficult to destroy was because it was so powerful and it was so economically successful that I don't see any reason to believe that it just would have died.
Well, I have been speaking with historian James Oakes, who's written an award-winning book about Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln and continues to write and study about that fascinating period of American history and illuminate us all about that. Dr. Oakes, it's been a great pleasure to have you in our studio.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Historian James Oakes will give a free public lecture titled The Emancipation Proclamation, Myths and Realities tonight at 8 o'clock in the University Center Ballroom on the University of Montana campus.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and lows 5 below to 12 below zero. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs 0 to 7 above. For central Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and lows 20 below to 30 below zero. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 5 below to 10 below zero. In southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and lows 10 below to 20 below zero. And tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 5 below to 5 above zero. And now for the editorial comments of Pam Gerwe.
Recently, I figured out that all I ever wanted was 25 chickens. I don't mean if only I had 25 chickens, my life would be complete. No, I mean all I ever wanted was 25 chickens, not 700. At the pinnacle of my chicken mania, my flock was about 450 laying hens and 250 baby chicks. We dispatched about 200 of the oldest birds that fall. So thankfully, I only had about 700 chickens for most of one summer. I fondly remember 20-plus years ago, our original tiny household flock of 6 to 8 barred rocks. The birds fit perfectly and easily into our lives, our yard, and the small camper originally designed to fit in the bed of a truck. And then, in 1996 or so, I went to an Aero annual meeting. Andy Lee, the keynote speaker, introduced me to the idea of chicken tractors. Chicken tractors are small mobile coops. The birds become mini tractors, eating weeds and bugs, tilling and fertilizing the field in their mobile pens. I came home from Aero's annual meeting ready to get serious about chickens. I had that gleam in my eye that my partner has come to recognize as me somehow roping him into work of epic proportions. And our life of chicken work did, indeed, become epic. We built 7 or 8 chicken tractors, each to house between 25 and 50 birds. Then the raccoon ripped the heads off of a bunch of chickens. So we restapled smaller mesh wire to each and every side of each and every tractor. And then the skunk burrowed under and killed some more. So we added an 18-inch wire skirt flayed on the ground at the base of each and every side of each and every tractor. Then the windstorm blew one of the tractors across the field, bouncing as it went, miraculously not killing or hurting even one bird, but causing grave concern as we witnessed the whole episode. Then we built a big, beautiful barn, one set of feeders and waterers, one set of roosts and nesting boxes, all in one centralized location. Somehow, I rationalized there was not much difference between watering and feeding just a few hundred more chickens, especially now that the girls were all centrally located. It would take just a few extra minutes to fill an additional water or two, but on the other end, it does not take just a few extra minutes to clean, store, and market a gazillion extra eggs. And even a few extra minutes here and there adds up on a busy first-generation farm. More nesting boxes to clean and fluff, more roosts to scoop poop from under, more, 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 and that's how I ended up with so many chickens. I hovered around 450 birds for most of a decade, and slowly, from the peak of my chicken mania, the numbers started to recede. Replacement orders of baby chicks became erratic, and our quantity discounts from the hatchery got smaller and smaller. Slowly, the flock got older, was replaced less frequently. Some of the birds died from attrition, the regular cast of predators, and occasional fall slaughter. And now, for the first time in over 20 years, I will spend my winter chickenless. I will eat plenty of chicken this winter, but a chickenless winter, as in no trudging out to the barn several times a day to feed, water, let out, check eggs, and then close in the birds each evening. A chickenless winter, as in I won't eat too many eggs. It was a difficult decision, but somehow fitting for me to spend the weekend of Aero's 39th annual meeting at home on the farm. It was the first annual meeting I've missed in over a decade. I stayed home, processing and getting into the freezer our diminished flock of about 40 hens and 2 roosters. Whitetail, the meanest rooster we ever had, now lives only in legend. For too many years, he terrorized children and adults who were victimized either by his actual rancor, witnessing it, or hearing stories of it. As we processed the birds all weekend, I thought about the amazing community of Aero members, the delicious food, the laughs I was missing. I thought about the new crop of babies and Food Corps volunteers. I thought about the speakers, the workshops, the new passion and ideas I was missing. I thought of all this and more as I spent the weekend not at Aero's 39th annual meeting, but at home, on the farm, processing and freezing the last birds of my diminished flock. In Whitefish, I'm Pam Gerwe for the Alternative Energy Resource Organization. Arrow has been linking people with sustainable agriculture and energy solutions since 1974. Visit us online at aeromt.org.
Pam Gurwey is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening.